Hello and welcome to Animal Voices. You're listening to CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm your host, Lauren Corman, here with Carl Orzechowski, teching for us, bringing us the news. On today's program, we're going to be speaking with Carrie Crone, and I'm really excited about this interview because I've seen Carrie give a couple of talks now, and she's has just fascinating stuff to say. I think especially for people who are interested in the animal movements, the animal welfare, and the animal rights and animal liberation movements, she has a lot of knowledge to offer about the history of the way that the animal movements have used visual images and how they've changed over time, and considering that the animal movements are so well known for using graphic imagery to get their point across, her historical and analytical perspective is really welcome. So Carrie Cronin is an assistant professor in the Department of Visual Arts at Brock University. We're going to talk with her at about the quarter after point, but before we do that, we'll hear some news.
Thank you, Lauren. The first story is coming to us today from the Daily Telegraph, Australia, and the headline is Celebrities Unite to Battle Animal Activists. Some of Australia's biggest names have told and this is according to the article, an extreme U.S. animal rights group to back off its campaign to boycott a national icon, as People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals convinced another international retailer to boycott Australian wool that has been mulesed. Leading fashion designer Alex Perry has thrown his weight behind the wool industry. Quote, PETA needs to back off, Mr. Perry said. Quote, I understand where they are coming from. There needs to be an alternative to mulesing, but give farmers a chance to develop it. Mulesing involves cutting the skin and wool from a sheep's backside to stop blowflies from laying eggs. Mr. Perry, along with rugby league star Nathan Hindmarsh, Meyer, country music singers Gina Jeffries, Shannon Null, and John Williamson want PETA to stop attacking wool farmers. Mr. Perry, the judge of Australia's Next Top Model, said executives sitting in offices overseas like New York should not be making a decision to boycott goods without all the facts. He used Australian wool in his recent winter collection and vowed to continue to use it in the future. Quote, wool is a huge export and the rest of the world gets our best, but PETA goes to the extreme and it doesn't understand how it impacts on our industry, he said. The industry, which last year exported 395,000 tons of wool valued at $2.09 billion, with a B, has agreed to phase out mulesing by 2010 and is already using alternatives like anesthetic and plastic clips, but PETA has not backed off. And the next story coming to us from MSNBC, the MSNBC website. I thought the story was really interesting. The headline is Demand Spikes at Pet Food Banks and Discount Vets. Diana Bardsley wiped tears from her eyes as she recalled taking food off her plate to feed her beloved spaniel Hunter and two Siamese cats. Her greatest fear? That she could be forced to surrender the animals as she struggled to stretch the food stamps and Social Security income to meet escalating costs of living. Some hope was restored after she visited a local food pantry, which has started offering free pet food to help owners keep their animals out of shelters. Quote, I know a lot of people will probably say, well, if you don't have enough money to be able to feed your animals, that you shouldn't have pets, said Bardsley, 53, of Franklin, as Hunter played in the living room with three of her grandchildren. But just because financially you may go downhill a little or a lot doesn't necessarily mean you have to give up part of your family that you love, she said. For some pet owners, though, there is little choice. The rising costs of fuel, food, and housing, and the rising tide of foreclosures have generated a surge in requests for pet food from traditional food pantries and prompted some pet owners to give up their animals. Others are trying to save money by foregoing veterinary care. The Animal Welfare League in Chicago Ridge, Illinois, has seen the average number of pet owners getting monthly rations from its pet food pantry increase by more than 50% since last year. Meanwhile, the number of people seeking service at its discounted veterinary clinic has more than doubled, said Linda Estrada, the group's director and president. Quote, we could do it every day if we had enough food. I mean, that's how bad it's gotten, she said. The line goes all the way down the street as pet owners gather once a month for supplies. In Santa Cruz, California, a pet food bank run by the Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals has seen demand spike by about 20% in just the past 6 months. The facility typically hands out about 5,000 pounds of free pet food a month. Quote, in the past, the demographics has been people who are disabled or on disability and senior citizens, said Executive Director Lisa Carter. Nowadays, during the pet food program, I see people who are able-bodied and not able to find a job. The deepening foreclosure crisis is also having an effect. A growing number of pet owners are abandoning their pets or surrendering them to shelters after losing their homes or being forced into housing that doesn't allow animals, says Brian Adams, spokesman for the Massachusetts SPCA. Quote, we've seen where people have abandoned dogs in the house, we've seen dogs that have been surviving for weeks on toilet water, we've seen dogs that have either been chained up outside or left in the yard when people have left, and we've seen cats that are just set free, Adams said. We've seen people do something sort of in the middle of the road, where they don't abandon the animal, they don't surrender the animal, but they give it to a neighbor or friend, and then that person brings it in maybe a week or two later when they realize, you know, it was something that was sort of dumped on them and they weren't really ready for it yet, he said. Petco Foundation, the charity arm of Petco Animal Supplies Incorporated, is establishing a program to provide up to $5,000 in grants to shelters to train, care for, or find new homes for pets abandoned during the foreclosure crisis. The program will also benefit shelters that help pet owners find homes that allow pets or supply food to disadvantaged homeowners who want to keep their animals. Linda Puglio, executive director of the Franklin Food Pantry Incorporated, said her organization has been struggling to keep up with the demands as it serves about 2,200 people, two-thirds of whom have pets. Quote, when we first started, people couldn't believe there'd actually be pet food because oftentimes they'd take 6 or 8 cans of tuna and we'd find out that they weren't actually eating it themselves. They were feeding the cats because they couldn't afford pet food, she said. And some veterinarians have noted more pet owners trying to save money on medical treatments by passing up some options, including diagnostic tests. Quote, where in the past they'd say, do anything that it takes, they are now being more conscious about what it will take, and then making those decisions, said Dr. Stephen Rowell, hospital director of the Cummings School of Veterinary Medicine at Tufts University. And the final story coming to us from an interesting source, labnews.co.uk, which is an insider magazine of the laboratory testing industry. And the headline is, New Guidelines Published as Mouse Models Thrown into Question. Just how relevant is the mouse model as a model for human disease? 5 of the UK's major funders of animal research have published guidelines for using animals in research, stating that funding will only be granted if, when collaborating with laboratories outside the UK, welfare standards are consistent with the principles in UK legislation and the new guidelines. Although some funders have published guidance previously, this is the first time that the MRC, BBSRC, NERC, Wellcome Trust, and NC3Rs have collaborated to produce a common set of principles for using animals in research and applying the 3Rs, which are replacement, refinement, and reduction. Sir Leszek Borisiewicz, chief executive of MRC, said, quote, the booklet sets out very clearly what the funders expect of those who work with animals. Good animal welfare and full implementation of the 3Rs are essential for good science and for retaining the support of the public in the use of animals in research. Steve Vischer, interim chief executive of BBSRC, said, basic science often reveals new options for replacing, refining, and reducing the number of animals in research. But that use remains necessary in many key areas of biomedical science. We welcome this opportunity to re-emphasize our commitment to ensure that scientists continue to work at the very high standards demanded by UK funders. The mouse is a well-used stand-in for humans in medical research thanks to genomes that are 85% identical, but identical genes may behave differently in mouse and man, a study by University of Michigan evolutionary biologists Ben Yang Liao and Jianji Zhang reveals. Quote, everyone assumes that deletion of the same gene in the mouse and in humans produces the same phenotype. That's the basis of using the mouse to study human disease, said Zhang, an associate professor of ecology and evolutionary biology. Quote, our results show that that may not always be the case. Zhang and Liao homed in on 120 essential human genes for which the mouse has an identical counterpart that has also been studied. If those 120 essential human genes are also essential in the mouse, deleting any of them should result in infertility or death before reproductive age. But their experiments showed an unexpected discrepancy. Quote, to our surprise, 22% of the 120 human essential genes are non-essential in the mouse. I expected there would be some, but I never expected the percentage to be so high. Zhang acknowledges that the study involved a relatively small number of genes and hopes that other researchers will be able to confirm the results. However, Nikki Gordon, science officer for the Dr. Hadwin Trust, a medical research charity that funds non-animal techniques to replace animal experiments, has echoed his concern with the mouse models. She told Laboratory News, quote, "We have long been concerned that equivalent genes in humans and mice don't have the same functional effects. Millions of genetically modified mice are used as research models for human disease every year, but the relevance of this research to human patients is highly questionable." And that is the news for today.
Great. Thanks, Carl. Did you want to offer any commentary on those pieces? How did you choose them?
The story about the pet food banks was just something that I have to say, like, I had never thought of that. I knew that, of course, it's not too difficult to imagine that people in difficult economic situations would, those situations would also impact animals that live with them, but to see it actually drawn out and explained in such a thorough way, I thought was pretty impressive. And to find it on MSNBC, I thought was also pretty interesting. And I came across the Lab News story on a listserv that I was on, and I thought it was worthwhile to maybe open a window into a debate that's happening internally within the animal testing industry, and to sort of show that while the debate is happening outside and while people are concerned outside about what is happening with animals and experimentation, there are people within the inside who are also concerned, and maybe that's an encouraging sign. Maybe not, but maybe it could be.
The food bank story reminded me of, we've covered this before about when, well, women in particular, although I'm sure it happens to men too, when they're trying to leave abusive relationships, mm-hmm. and some people won't go because they're afraid of what will happen to their companion animal, and some of the shelters, a lot of the shelters won't take in an animal as well, so it's something that encumbers people from leaving, and so people who've done animal work and work on behalf of violence against women have pushed to have shelters bring in animals or to create shelters where animals are welcome. So, I mean, I think that's just another one of the examples of how social issues and animal issues collide in these ways. And I was, of course, thinking of Jason Reibel because we interviewed him a while ago about an article that he had written called Animals Are Part of the Working Class. We talked more broadly about that, but also about class in general and how it intersects with animal issues. So if you're interested in that interview, you can go to our website, animalvoices.ca, and you can write us at animalvoices@gmail.com. Animalvoices.ca, we have over 230 programs that you can download for free. So we're going to take a short musical break. We'll come back with Carrie Cronin, assistant professor in the Department of Visual Arts at Brock University. Please stay tuned. Welcome back to Animal Voices. Today we're speaking with Dr. Carrie Cronin, who is an assistant professor in the Department of Visual Arts at Brock University. Her research and teaching interests focus on the ways in which visual representations of the non-human world have historically shaped, challenged, and at times subverted dominant human attitudes towards the species they share the planet with. It's my great pleasure to have Dr. Cronin here today. I'm really excited to speak with you. Hi, Carrie.
Hi, Lauren. How are you?
Good. How are you doing?
Good, thank you.
So let's just kick it off by talking a little bit, getting some of the terminology out of the way. I know that a phrase that we'll be using is visual culture. Can you tell us about what that means?
Sure. Visual culture, of course, has its basis in art history, and most of us that are studying and writing about visual culture are art historians by training, but it's expanding this idea of sort of how images work in our society. So, for instance, I teach a course called Introduction to Visual Culture at Brock, which students learn about things like film and advertising and how science uses images. So it's expanding sort of the ideas that we take from traditional art history and applying it to a much wider range of visual images and products in our society, and thinking about how they shape ideas and how the visual really helps us understand a lot of human dynamic and, of course, in my research, interspecies dynamics.
Is there a bit of a rivalry between visual culture and art history, the people who do that work, or is it a nice synergy that happens within the fields?
That's a great question. I think in my experience, I've noticed there's a wonderful synergy And at Brock, actually, we model that synergy quite well. Our first year course, which is a context course that a lot of incoming students take, about 150 a year, is divided into the two halves. There's art history and visual culture. And the two courses do speak quite well to one another. So when students have completed that course, they have an understanding of sort of the great works of art and how we've sort of come to understand those throughout time, but they also have sort of a critical model of looking at how images function in a broader sense. And so what we're doing with those two courses, I think, really mirrors a lot of what's happening in the academic field of art history and visual culture. And there's certainly a lot more interdisciplinary approaches being taken these days in this kind of study. Mm.
Can you give us a sense of what brought you to this field yourself to end up teaching? I don't imagine that you did your undergrad, although maybe in visual culture. Where did you start?
Well, I did a studio program in photography at the Northern Alberta Institute of Technology, and I wanted to be a photographer, but after I graduated, it was sort of hard to get a job as a photographer. So I ended up taking a job at the Provincial Archives of Alberta, where my primary job each day was working in the darkroom printing old glass plate negatives for researchers and other customers who ordered copies of these prints. It was such a wonderful experience. Being in the darkroom all day and looking at these old images really got me thinking about the history of images and how they have functioned in our society and what they mean to people, both on a sort of broader cultural level, but also sort of this personal connection that we have with images. So this is really something that began to fascinate me a lot. And then I discovered it was possible to major in art history. I had no idea. I really had no idea this was something that people did. So I went back to university and did a BA in art history at the University of Alberta, and then proceeded to do graduate work in the field at Queen's University. So that's sort of the long, roundabout way how I came to study and teach visual culture.
And how did the piece about non-human, the non-human world, and how this figures into imagery, how did that end up happening?
It was sort of a circuitous route. As I was completing my degree, I became quite politically active and politically aware, as undergraduate students often do. Sometimes I discover with my own students, too, sometimes it's the first awakening of sort of a political consciousness if one hasn't been sort of exposed to those issues in other arenas of their life. And so this is something that was happening to me as I was studying at the U of A. I was joining environmental clubs. I was going to environmental rallies. I was reading books about environmentalism. I became vegetarian at this time. But what was happening, though, is I was sort of seeing that dynamic as separate from my studies. So it was like they almost existed in two separate realms. You know, on the one hand, this is what I study, this is what I'm working on. On the other hand, this is something that's important to me and something that I feel strongly about in my personal life. Anyhow, I got into more advanced seminars in art history, and our readings and our discussions in those classes got us thinking about some of the more critical ways of engaging with imagery. So, for example, feminist analysis of images and that kind of thing. And I started thinking more and more about how images, artwork, visual culture, whatever terminology we want to use now, but how this image culture can really construct and shape and reinforce dominant power relationships. And so then I began thinking about how this played out in an environmental context, this notion of environmentalism sort of developing in my mind, being a very important part of my personal life. And so I started looking around. I was a grad student at the time, you know, hungry for readings and knowledge, and I began looking around for books and articles addressing these power dynamics from an environmental point of view. And I remember feeling very, very frustrated because I wasn't finding what I was looking for. I had this notion in my head that, you know, we can take these ideas of power dynamics and imagery that was coming out in feminist art history or other types of art history and apply it to the environment, but it wasn't something I was finding a lot of work on. And I remember one day sitting in a seminar class which was focused on the subject of landscape painting. And one of the students in the class, he was a fellow from the English department, was talking about his research. And he was talking about how he was working on the poet John Clare and how he was analyzing Clare's poetry using an eco-critical methodology. And that's the first time I had heard of eco-criticism, and I nearly fell off my chair. This was something that I'd been looking for this whole time, but I didn't have the vocabulary or the critical skills yet to talk about it in that way. So I began tracking down everything I could read in the field of English literature on eco-criticism, and this is just a couple of years after Cheryl Glatfelter's groundbreaking eco-criticism reader. So even in the field of English literature, this is still very new and very exciting. But I began taking these courses and reading these texts and thinking about how I could apply these ideas to the visual rather than written or textual material. And that really was sort of when the light bulb came on, as we say, in terms of how I wanted to develop and take my own research and go from there.
Mm. For myself, trying to finish up my PhD in environmental studies at York, one of the things that I've observed about being in the faculty for so long and going to different environmental studies conferences is that when people do bring in environmental themes into, you know, fields like cultural studies or English, that often the role of the quote-unquote animal, the animal, is kind of on the sidelines. It's not necessarily brought into the fore. It's sort of considered within larger theoretical perspectives about nature. And I think that that's important, but it often misses the particularity of the animals themselves. And one of the things that I've appreciated about hearing you talk, the times that I've seen you present your work, is that you're willing to go into and consider the animal more particularly. Can you talk about some of the research that you've done that has considered animals?
Certainly. One of the projects that I'm working on right now is one that has to do with anti-vivisection campaigns in the 19th century. And I'm presenting this work in Manchester next week at a conference called Science and the Public. And I'm looking at how activists such as Frances Power Cobb turned to medical textbooks that had these graphically illustrated instructions for how medical students and physicians should be conducting experiments on animal bodies. And what Cobb and others did was take pages directly out of those manuals and appropriate the images into their own activist campaigns. And so I'm looking at how that process of appropriation shapes the knowledge and the understanding of this type of imagery. And Cobb found this to be a very successful technique because it allowed her to have a voice of authority in terms of these anti-vivisection activist campaigns that she was spearheading. What I mean by that is that she wasn't dismissed as sort of a hysterical, emotional female, which may have been the rhetoric in the 19th century, and instead she was showing these very austere, what she perceived to be neutral images because they came out of a medical textbook.
Mm.
And so that's what I'm working on right now, is this notion of appropriating the image and seeing it in different contexts and how that works. Other work that I've done on the animal body, one of the earliest projects I did on this theme had to do with dress reform and fashion in Victorian England, specifically with these campaigns attempting to stop the use of feathers and other bird parts on dresses and hats and bonnets, which was very, very fashionable at this time. And I think probably because of the centrality of the spectacle in the fashion world, this campaign in particular really did rely on the visual. And so what I found in my research was all sorts of illustrated leaflets, cartoons in magazines such as Punch, and oil on paintings, or oil and canvas, excuse me, paintings on this theme of stopping cruelty towards, in this case, birds very specifically. So that was another project that I did on the theme of the animal body. Another one that I think you perhaps heard me speak about at a conference had to do with representations of wildlife in Canada's national parks, specifically in terms of tourist commodity culture, such as the postcard, and how that type of visual rendition gets repeated again and again in the rhetoric of tourism.
Can we just jump back for a second? I'd like to go through all of them, but I wanted to go back to Frances Power Cobb. Could you tell us about how her work then was situated within a larger context of activism at the time? Was she sort of a lone voice out there doing something different than what other people that were interested in raising questions about animals were doing, or was she typical at the time?
She certainly was part of a larger dynamic of social reform that was happening at the time. And what's interesting when you go back and look at these campaigns for animal welfare in the 19th century, they're very clearly linked to other types of activism that's going on at the time. So the suffragette movement or anti-slavery, those kinds of things, certainly we see similar people appearing again and again in these campaigns. So she was part of this larger dynamic of social reform. In terms of animal welfare, again, there was a few other people working with these issues, but I think she was probably one of the most outspoken and therefore one of the most well-known. She got a lot of press for her views. And her appropriation of the images, I think, was quite unique. Certainly, she wasn't the only one that was doing this kind of thing, but I think she did it in a very sophisticated way that really makes me want to stop and take a closer look at what she was doing, just in terms of the sheer numbers of images that she was appropriating out of these medical textbooks.
Would you say that she was effective then?
I think that she certainly was. She really got a lot of, for lack of a better term, airtime for her work because of people wanting to listen to what she had to say because of this angle of authority that she was appropriating from the medical textbooks. There are other activists that were around at the same time using imagery. For instance, another dynamic of my research is looking at the Toronto Humane Society's use of things like lantern slides to teach children how to be kind to animals. But those images had a much more sentimental quality to them. So there's this very sort of nice, harmonious way of being in the world, sharing space with animals, being kind, putting blankets on horses when it's cold, that sort of thing. But the images that Cobb was using were so startling in their graphic quality. Their diagrams, for instance, showing how to cut the top of the skull off a rabbit's head to conduct experiments, and it's very clinical and matter of fact. And I think that was very, very jarring for a lot of people.
Can you tell us more about how these images? You said that it was striking that Frances Parr Cobb used such graphic images. And I think often when people think about the animal rights movement today, they often think also of those very graphic images. Did she sort of start that trend towards let's show the violence that is happening and put that out into the public sphere? Was she sort of the beginning of that trend?
No, I wouldn't say that she was the first doing that. Much earlier in the 19th century, there were groups such as the Animal Friend, who produced publications with images that were intended to be very, very shocking and very graphic. The difference is that most of those images can't be traced back to a specific source or a specific event that they viewed. There's a lot of suspicion that perhaps a lot of them were fabricated images made out of imaginations of the artists putting together stories that they heard. Nonetheless, what they were depicting were things like what it would look like in a slaughterhouse. So there's these really gruesome scenes of these monstrous-looking butchers stomping on animals as they were being thrown down the stairs unceremoniously for slaughter. That kind of thing was front and center on the pages of the Animal Friend magazine. Another one that really stuck with me, even after all these years, was an image showing a calf hung upside down on what looks like a crucifix, and underneath was a caption describing that this is the process of killing a cow for making veal, in that the cow's throat would be slit, the blood would drain out, and this would produce a better quality of meat. Mm. And so the image, of course, is this gruesome drawing of this poor cow alive still on this crucifix upside down, with the blood seeping out of its body. So these were shocking, shocking images. But as I said, the difference with Cobb is that her source is very, very clear. This is coming from a published text, where these earlier ones, it's not possible to determine for sure whether this was actually witnessed events or if they were sort of embellished based on conversations that the artist had with activists.
Yeah, and that's in terms of what you were talking about before, with her being able to establish the voice of authority, I think is how you put it. Did people take her seriously then, in terms of that strategy to use those images that she wasn't creating herself but appropriating?
Some did and some didn't. I mean, this is very obviously contentious subject matter, and in particular for a woman in this, these days, to be sort of leading the charge for. So she did receive a lot of ridicule and criticism directed towards her. But certainly it did help sort of create a groundswell for this anti-vivisection movement in the United Kingdom, which sort of spilled over into North American context as well. So I would argue that her work is fairly successful in this regard, just for the sheer attention that it received.
Mm.
Even the act of appropriating in itself is controversial, and that controversy stirred up, you know, more discussion of her and what she was doing. So certainly the awareness was raised.
What was the controversy about then, whether or not she should be able to use those images in that way?
Certainly that came up. You know, this was not the intent of the images. This was not the intent of sort of the authors of these textbooks. A lot of them were coming from French medical schools. And so there was that kind of dynamic and discussion going on around these images as well.
In terms of the motivation of those early animal activists, was it about like a civilizing impulse in a way about if we do this to animals, this leads to the degradation of society, and it also affects how people treat each other? Or was it, or would you say it was about the animals themselves?
That's a really great question, and we see a very distinct shift happening about the mid-19th century. Prior to this, in the 18th and the early 19th century, a lot of the artists who were engaging with these themes of animal welfare, animal cruelty, were playing into a larger dominant social idea about treating animals well for the betterment of human society. So in other words, they believed that if people had the capacity to be cruel to other forms of life, it wouldn't be much of a stretch for them to be cruel to one another. So there very much was this notion of bettering human society in this period of the 18th and early 19th century. I think one of the most well-known examples of this kind of attitude expressed in visual culture is a series of prints by William Hogarth, the well-known English artist, and perhaps you're familiar with them. They're reproduced in many contexts. He did a series of four prints in 1751, and these prints were called The Four Stages of Cruelty. And these four images trace the life of a fictional character who Hogarth has named Tom Nero. And in the first print, we see Tom Nero as a young boy. And he's playing pranks on animals. He's chasing them. He and his friends are hitting a dog with a stick. They're being cruel boys, and they're attacking these birds and dogs that exist in their home and their neighborhood. The second image, we see Tom as a young man, and he's beating his carriage horse that has fallen down on the street out of pure exhaustion. And as the series progresses, of course, Tom is getting more and more violent. And what ends up happening is that he commits a murder. And the last print in the series shows violence toward Tom himself, his body, after an execution. He was tried and convicted for murder. So what Hogarth is doing with this series then is showing this progression of violence and very clearly commenting on a human being who has the capacity to be cruel to animals also has the capacity to be cruel to other humans, and therefore this is something that needs to be eradicated and taken care of in society. So Hogarth certainly wanted to stop cruelty towards animals, and there's this wonderful quote about him speaking about his work, talking about how if his images could stem this tide of cruelty, he would be as proud of them as if he were the artist who painted great Renaissance masterpieces. It's a wonderful quote that he has. But the underlying message in these images really does tie into the broader social ideas at the time, in that animal cruelty in and of itself wasn't the main concern. It was the betterment of human society. By the mid-19th century, though, we start to see a shift, and we start to see people taking animal cruelty seriously in itself. So stopping animal cruelty for the sake of being kind to animals, and not necessarily as concerned with what it's doing to the larger human society. Mm. And so this shift then takes place about the mid-19th century. And by the late 19th century, in the Victorian era, we see a lot more of these approaches towards depicting animals and animal cruelty for the sake of stopping cruelty itself.
Would you say that those earlier activists that were framing their work within that sort of larger social context, that this would be about the betterment of society, do you think that's sort of akin to how sometimes people do shallow or light environmentalism now? Say, it's if you're good to the environment, it helps us too. You know, this is ultimately about humanity's survival. Was it a strategic choice, or was it really just about resonating their work, resonating and then just reproducing the cultural ideas of the time?
I think it depends on the artist. Someone like Hogarth, if you read his letters and his writings, he was very passionately committed to stopping cruelty to animals. It really affected him quite deeply. There are other artists, I'm sure, that were picking up on sort of a moral tide that was more predominant in society and not necessarily as personally engaged with the issues, but rather maybe saw the prints as a way to sort of make a sale, that kind of thing. But someone like Hogarth, for sure, was passionately committed to stopping this kind of behavior. Talked about it a lot in his writings and in his work.
One of the things that I've noticed about studying the way that animal activism is often done now and really over the past decades is that people often use the rhetoric of showing what was hidden, or of course there's the maxim about if slaughterhouses had glass walls, we'd all be vegetarian. And there's this idea that with the beginning of industrialization, as things become more institutionalized, animal use becomes institutionalized and behind closed doors, that the way of activism, of animal activism, is about trying to expose what is happening behind those sort of sheltered aspects of modernity in a way. Can you talk a little bit about whether or not that was also the case, or was that a continuation of rhetoric that was happening beforehand about exposing the cruelty? Because I know in some of the images that you've shown before that this was really about, at least in some cases, it was about animal cruelty that was already happening in the public realm that people did see on a day-to-day basis.
Absolutely. I think that idea of using images to expose what is hidden and what is not in view has been an important part of animal activist imagery throughout this period that I've been studying. You're right, though. There are also aspects where, for instance, in the city of London, where slaughterhouses were more in the city, there are images playing on that. There's a couple of really interesting images coming from those publications I mentioned earlier, The Animal Friend, sort of demonizing what wasn't hidden from view. So the marketplace where animals were taken to be slaughtered, yes, this is something that people would see and would pass on a daily basis. So the images then sort of up the ante almost. They were done at night. There were torches, sort of the faces of the animal handlers and those who were in charge of the slaughter become demonized. They reduce the sort of essential features of the face. They look sort of ghoul-like. There's these sort of dark shadows. All of this is a drawing, of course, but the artist is taking liberty and conveying the sort of sinister sense, going above and beyond perhaps what might have been seen. In terms of people gaining access to areas that they wouldn't necessarily have access to, again, those publications talked about sending reporters or artists in disguise, perhaps as inspectors or perhaps as potential customers, going down underground, places that they might not normally gain access to in order to witness what was happening and then draw it or depict it or write about it and expose it for public to see. Frances Power Cobb, again, going back to her work, she titled one of her books Light in Dark Places. And of course, she's alluding to this notion of using imagery to shed light on what normally is hidden from view, the vivisector's lab or medical laboratories. Not something that's openly accessible to the public. So using image culture to bring that out to the public realm.
One of the things that struck me about what you were saying is this idea of demonization. And can you talk a little bit more about how people were portrayed that were participating in these types of animal cruelty, and then maybe what the effects of that were, and if that continues through the history until the present time?
Certainly. One of the interesting shifts that happens is that a lot of the earlier work is focusing on behavior of sometimes the working and lower class. So those who were working in slaughterhouses, those who were in charge of places like the knacker's yard, which is where horses were sent to die when they were too old or too weak to pull carriages in the streets. And so there was this, almost a sense of, if we can better society, if we can educate people about, you know, these types of behaviors and why they're wrong, then we can sort of, society can get better, all of those things that we were speaking about a few minutes ago. What's interesting towards the end of the 19th century is when the campaigns towards vivisection really got going. And here we have doctors or medical students, and they tended to be members of sort of the middle, upper middle, and upper classes that were being targeted. And this is a really big shift. The other shift in representation, another example, is with regard to fashion. And again, this idea of using feathers or furs as part of clothing and costume was directed towards middle and upper class consumers, those who had the disposable income, the leisure time, to participate in something like the fashion industry. So the shift is really quite a fascinating one. We're going from a notion of educating those who perhaps didn't know better to almost poking fun at a group of society who maybe should know better. Hmm. And I'm thinking particularly of the fashion example. Punch had a lot of cartoons dedicated to this theme of abolishing the practice or the trend of wearing feathers and bird parts. And they were doing so by making fun of the women who did this. And so we have these monstrous depictions of women with half human, half animal bodies, and represented as these sort of foolish creatures who were participating in this horrible act. And so definitely there's a change in how the people were represented.
So this is an unfair question, I know, and I always ask it for the academics that we interview. So what would you say to an animal activist that maybe is listening now, or somebody who's interested in these issues, about why having this historical perspective, what relevance does it have now, or can it show us something about what current practices or current representations are about?
Absolutely. I think that's a great question, and I think that this kind of history helps us sort of trace a trajectory of the legacy of animal activism and animal welfare images. A lot of what we see nowadays certainly has its roots in these earlier practices. I'm thinking specifically about the use of images that can be quickly and easily reproduced, so print, photographs, now with the internet technology. The underlying idea is that images need to be quickly, cheaply disseminated. This has a legacy that goes back far beyond our own current time. We can look to work that someone like Frances Harrah Cobb was doing. How did her techniques, were they effective? Did they help raise awareness? What were sort of the critiques against her? I think these are things that we can look very closely at in our current times and think about how we want to model our activist behavior or our thoughts towards animal activism. What techniques have been effective? Why? How can we sort of push the envelope? Those kinds of things.
I've always appreciated the work of Steve Baker, and he has a chapter in Picturing the Beast where he talks about the strategic uses of images for the animal rights movement. And I was wondering what your take is on where people are most effective now, and what are some of the insights that can be brought from that historical perspective into perhaps using images more effectively in the future.
I think one of the things that comes up in Steve Baker's writing is the use of controversy. And how, as I've been speaking about, sort of the shock value of images, whether it's through activist campaigns or sometimes artistic work, often really gets people to stop and think about what they're seeing and what they're engaging with. And I think this very clearly ties back to some of these historical precedents in terms of sort of jarring people into a sense of awareness and thinking about what it is they're looking at. This idea of controversy, as we've been talking about, certainly comes out in contemporary artwork, and Baker himself, as you know, writes a lot about this. But one thing that he talks about too is not having a very clear, one-dimensional way of looking at animals and animal imagery. And this, of course, ties into Erica Fudge's writing on the word animal and how we maybe need to think more about other ways of describing and engaging with what we're seeing and what we're working with. I think Baker and Fudge are very similar in that way, in that they're both arguing for numerous perspectives to be taken into account, that there's not just one way of thinking about animals, or one way of picturing animals, or one way of engaging with animals. And I think that their work really opens up a lot of doors for people working in this field to think about these multiple perspectives. Mm.
Can you tell us more in concrete terms what that would look like for people who maybe aren't familiar with their work?
Certainly. Erica Fudge, for instance, talks a lot about when we use the word animal, it's used both for things like companion animals or pets, dogs and cats. We also use the same vocabulary animal when we're talking about lab rats or meat, you know, the animal body that gets turned into steak or meat. And so she's arguing that instead of just using the same kind of language, we need to sort of break down this notion of the animal into other aspects and thinking more about how many different roles animal bodies or the animal play in our society. And so she's arguing for this need to sort of get past these descriptions of just animal or animal welfare or environmental movement and to think about what those mean in different terms and how we can look at the different meanings that come out of those engagements.
What's your take on some of the images or videos, films that are coming out of the animal movements, let's say over the past decade? The images like The Peaceable Kingdom, or there's a very graphic film called Earthlings, or various different PETA videos, or those, again, the Tribe of Heart film, The Witness. Are you familiar with any of those, or any other of the visual imagery that the animal rights movement in particular has been using? And if so, what is your take on how people are using those images?
I think the use of graphic images is ultimately a very important part of activism, in that it really does force the viewer to confront these issues head on and really think about things that perhaps are often hidden from sight or not part of our day-to-day awareness. With the use of graphic images, however, I think there are a number of dangers that we need to certainly be aware of. First of all, I think too many of these images or this type of product may lead to a desensitization on the part of the public. So these graphic images may start out to be shocking, horrifying, disturbing, upsetting, but overexposure perhaps can dull this impact to the point in which they just become another image in our visually driven society. So just one more piece of visual clutter, if you will, in our society today. So that's a danger that I would worry about, and certainly it's a fine line. I mean, they are effective, but you know, how much is too much? That's something to be aware of. Secondly, of course, there's this exploitive nature of these images, you know, animal death, animal suffering, you know, putting a camera in on it and exposing it certainly does raise awareness, but is it sort of crossing a boundary in terms of ethics, in terms of perhaps glorifying violence or suffering? And so those are questions, again, that we need to ask ourselves and keep in the back of our mind as we're looking at this proliferation of these kinds of images. Mm.
It's interesting, again, with the rhetoric around some of the images, it's this idea that visual imagery is the way that animals can speak for themselves. And I spent a lot of time thinking about orality and the way that people talk about animals. I think that's very interesting that that's sort of seen as a place of potential resistance or an assertion of agency on behalf of the animal is through this sort of really graphic imagery, that's when they're representing their suffering themselves and somehow speaking back to the public. And I feel very muddled about how I sort of make sense of that, because I think in some ways it can be an act of extreme appropriation, exploitation, to use those types of images. But at the same time, I think that there's some seed in that speaks to how animals do look back, or how animals do have agency, and that I think that one of the things I take so strongly out of feminist theory and the feminist movements is not to render others as victims, or at least as total victims, where they cannot assert themselves back in any kind of way. So it's sort of a bunch of different things that I wanted to throw out there and to see if you could perhaps respond to that question of agency and animal representation.
Certainly. The question of agency is a huge part of the work that we do in this field yourself. and others as well doing work on this. And I think that it's important to always keep that in mind when we're thinking about representation and representational strategies for activists and for academics, how we're thinking about these depictions. In terms of animals having agency and this process of looking back, as you suggest, I think that on the one hand, as you mentioned, those images of violence and of dying or suffering animals does achieve that. But as you said, I'm not sure I'm comfortable with the full implications of this, turning the suffering into an object for the gaze and the power dynamics that go around that. When you look at the work of somebody like Ollie and Susie, for instance, who try and engage with animals and animal participation or in the art-making process in a sort of a different way, it's less violent, but I'm not sure it has the same impact in terms of being able to grab the viewer and make them stop and think about what is going on in the picturing process. So it really is a fine balance, as you suggested, between how far we're willing to go with these sort of graphic images versus the need to sort of pull back in terms of ethical considerations. Mm.
One of the things that I mean, really struck me about the Ollie and Susie stuff that I had learned about through Stephen Baker's work is this idea of the animal as participant in artwork, and to shift the idea, even if it's not successful, or perhaps it is, but the idea of shifting the idea of the animal as object and the photographer or the artist as subject, and that it seems to disrupt something about the gaze or the way representation has been constructed, with humans always being at the center of that and the defining frame. Could you talk a little bit about what potentials that you see, or I guess maybe reflect on, if you could, that idea of participation a little bit more?
Certainly. Ollie and Susie, as you know, often have animals participate in the process by getting the animal they're depicting to make some kind of mark on the paper. So they're drawing a picture of an animal and then having that animal either, you know, bite the paper or leave a stain or a paw print on the image. And certainly that, I understand conceptually where they're going with this, and I think it's quite interesting in that they're participating with the animal creator in this instance. There's something in my mind that feels a little bit, I hesitate to use the word gimmicky, but I think I will, in terms of what they're doing here, in that it seems to me just part of this sort of larger, long-standing practice of using animals for a source of entertainment. Mm. In terms of contemporary art, I think an artist who does a much better job of raising questions about how humans interact with and think about other species is Polly Morgan. She's a London-based artist who does taxidermy. So she's working with the dead body again, but she takes bodies of dead animals who have been found or donated to her through vet offices. And through taxidermy, she incorporates them into her artwork. And so there's still this sort of sense of collaborating, even though the animal is dead, but it's such an important part of the artwork. And she doesn't kill in the name of art, but she takes these animals who are already dead and, again, making visible that which we tend to either ignore or have as invisible parts of our culture, roadkill. We drive by it, we may be sad for a moment, but then we, you know, get on with our day. And she's taking that and making it front and center in an art exhibition and making us think about sort of how this kind of animal interaction occurs in our society. And I think that she does some really interesting work raising questions about these issues, a little more so than someone like Ollie and Susie.
Mm. So there's other examples of collaboration or participation, at least done in different ways, that people could pursue if they're interested in looking at these issues further. Yeah,
I think so. Unfortunately, in that case, I mean, the animals are dead. But there's that sense that they come to her and they are, the pieces get shaped based on sort of the animals that she has brought to her or donated to her.
We're out of time, and I still wanted to ask you about so many different things, the elephant painting stuff, which was really big over the past little while, and I wanted to turn it over to you and to get you to offer final thoughts, but we're out of time, so I really hope you'll come back and join us again on the program. It was really wonderful speaking with you.
I certainly will. Thank you, Lauren.
Thanks so much.
Have a great day.
You too.
Okay,
bye. Bye. We were speaking with Dr. Carrie Cronin. She's an assistant professor in the Department of Visual Arts at Brock University. Time really got away from me today. It was great talking with her. This program will be archived on our website, animalvoices.ca. Please stay tuned. Dos Mundos coming up with Sergio.